All right, well, thanks for coming back. Appreciate it. So I got to say quickly, naming your son Isaac after that story did make me pause, and we still did it. But yeah, you'll have to ask me about that sometime. So another promise, another prophecy that was made to Abraham, as we just picked this right back up, is found in Genesis chapter 15. And it's in verse 13. And we're going to actually spend some time unpacking this. Verse 13, Genesis 15, verse 13 says, "Know for certain," God is saying to Abraham, "know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own." And then Genesis goes on. We'll come back to the rest of that verse in a second. But Genesis goes on to describe how Abraham's son Isaac had sons himself, Jacob and Esau. And there's a lot that goes into their story. We're going to speed right past. Then they talk about Jacob's sons sold their brother, Joseph. There was one brother, Joseph, who was sold into slavery. And then God, putting his hand on Joseph's life, raised him to this place of power. Even though he was a slave in Egypt, he actually was raised to be the prime minister of Egypt, the second in command of the whole superpower of the modern world at that time. And because Joseph was in this powerful position, God used him to save his dad and his family and save them from a terrible famine that struck the land. And his whole family, probably about 70 people in all, was able to move into Egypt and not die of starvation like a lot of the world in that time did. And that fulfilled the first part of the prophecy that Abraham's descendants would end up strangers in another country. But there was more to the prophecy. The second part of that prophecy said, and they will be enslaved and mistreated there. Then God continues, "But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions." So Abraham has this promise that his descendants are going to end up in another country for 400 years. They will be enslaved and mistreated in that country during that time, but then they'll come out with riches. And so for the rest of the night, we're going to take a look at how God works out that promise that he made to Abraham. So as Joseph and his family continue to live in Egypt and the years pass and generations start to go by, life gets pretty rough for the Israelites. We're going to pick up the story in the book of Exodus in chapter 1. And if you're in the Element Bible, that's on page 29. So we're now in the next book in the Bible, just like that. All right. So starting in verse 6, and again, I'm reading NIV as well. "Now Joseph and all his brothers and all of that generation died. But the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, to whom Joseph meant nothing, came to power in Egypt. 'Look,' he said to his people, 'the Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, for they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, they will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country.'" So evidently, the great wisdom that Joseph had shown and actually the provision that was made because of Joseph's wisdom that made Egypt rich, those were forgotten over the years. And this new king could only see that there was this great population of a minority that was in his country, and he felt that they would soon become a majority, and he was afraid. And so this new pharaoh embarks on a couple of campaigns to tamp down or maybe even eliminate the Israelites. First, he starts ramping up the intensity of their slavery and mistreating them. And then he shifts to systematically killing their male babies as they are born, trying to bring the population down. And if you think about it, it could be that Satan was at work behind the scenes trying to eliminate Israel so that he could keep the Messiah from coming. That would be in line with his character and previous attempts that he seems to have made to oppose God's purposes. But it was about this time that God brings a Hebrew boy named Moses onto the scene. And he was the one who would lead the Israelites out of this bondage. The Bible spends a good bit of time on this, but Moses in his early life, till he was about 40 years old, looked like this. First, he was in line to be killed by that campaign to murder the Israelites' babies, and yet he was spared. He was rescued by Pharaoh's actual daughter and raised in Pharaoh's house, which meant he actually benefited from the education of the Egyptian system. So he would have gotten probably the best education available in that era. But he still knew that he was a Hebrew and identified himself as a Hebrew. He saw an Egyptian who was a slave driver beating another Israelite, and he stepped in and tried to break it up, and he ended up killing the Israelite and burying him in the sand because he just couldn't see his own people suffer. Then he runs away from Egypt to a place called Midian so that he wouldn't be killed by the people in Egypt. So then he spends his middle years, 40 years, in Midian as a shepherd. So you've got educated, elite education, tending sheep for 40 years. I got to think that was humbling for a guy named Jethro. And he marries Jethro's daughter, Zipporah. And they have a son. And then, at about 80 years old, something changes. Moses sees a burning bush in Exodus chapter 3. And this bush is on fire, and God speaks to him from this bush, and he tells Moses that he's chosen Moses as his instrument to save the Israelites from their bondage. So Moses and his brother Aaron go together to Pharaoh to tell him that God wanted to let the Israelites go. And so now we start to see this deliverance from Egypt is just starting. Well, Pharaoh refuses to listen to God. And so God decides to intervene. And he sends plagues on the Egyptians. And these plagues had several different purposes. You've probably heard about the plagues before. We'll cover them very briefly. But these purposes for the plagues really were, first, judgments on Pharaoh for his hard heart, for turning and oppressing the Israelites. They were also judgments on the people of Egypt for following false gods and not turning to God. They were a way of forcing the Egyptians to let the Israelites go so that God could deliver them out of their bondage in Egypt. And they were also judgments on the gods of Egypt. And there's a little link on your handout. If you use the QR code, you can jump to Eric Jafruti's sermon on the plagues of Egypt, where he did this really cool comparison of how the gods of Egypt map to the plagues. And I'd encourage you to look at that, because the Egyptians had gods of the sun and the moon and the Nile River and other aspects that each of these plagues seems to speak against and show that God was more powerful than the Egyptian gods. So there were actually 10 plagues that were levied against Egypt, and I'm going to go through them extremely fast. The first plague, water was turned into blood, including the Nile River. So their main life source water is now blood. The second plague was the land was covered with frogs, which had to be annoying. Then the third plague was gnats, or they could have been lice or sand fleas or something, but the Hebrew word is talking about insects that fasten to you, so they don't really let go. Has to be fun, right? The fourth plague was flies all over the place, and they were biting flies that would bite people. They didn't maybe hang on, but they still bit you. Then the fifth plague is that all of the Egyptian cattle died. So now their cattle are dead. The sixth plague is people, men, or humans, and animals became covered with boils. I actually had a boil once. It hurt really bad. I can't imagine having them everywhere. Then it gets worse. The seventh plague, there's this hailstorm that strips every tree. It wrecks all of their crops, and it kills animals and humans. Again, more destruction. Right behind them comes the eighth plague, which is locusts that devour basically anything that the hailstorm left behind in terms of plants. And then the ninth plague, the whole land of Egypt is plunged into darkness, except for this little part where the Israelites lived, which still had light. And actually, the fourth through the tenth plagues, the Bible is clear to show that the Israelites are spared from these judgments. There's a distinction between what happens to the Egyptians and what happens to the Israelites. And it's probable that they were spared from the other plagues as well, but at least these ones are specifically mentioned. There's a difference. And it's showing that God has the power to overcome the Egyptian gods, but also to spare his own people, and that he alone was the all-powerful God. Well, Pharaoh somehow still refuses, and I think a part of it is because these plagues were imitated. And so your first blank in your handout is imitated. The plagues were imitated, which led to Pharaoh's refusal, which is your second blank, refusal. And part of this Pharaoh's refusal really seems to be based on the fact that he had some magicians, and these magicians were able to imitate two of these plagues. They were able to turn water into blood, so now they have more blood on their hands, and they also were able to produce more frogs. So they had frogs everywhere, but now they have more frogs, which seems fun. But the lesson to pull from that is that this shows us that Satan has power, that he can imitate things that God can do, and he has some supernatural ability, even in displaying his power through people that are following him. And he has always demonstrated himself as a counterfeiter, trying to pass himself off as God, appearing as an angel of light, and even doing things that look like miracles. So I think it's a good reminder for us to just be discerning. When we see something miraculous and we see something supernatural, to remember that not everything that's miraculous comes from God. We need to be careful in discerning, looking at purposes, looking at other reasons to see if it's really from God. But also realize that Satan can only do what God allows him to do. He can't do miracles that overcome God. So then next, after Pharaoh refuses, we actually see God's mercy offered. And so the next blank is mercy offered. God's mercy is offered to Pharaoh. And as you go through this story, if you read through each plague and each encounter, you see that God is being very gracious to Pharaoh. He just wanted Pharaoh to let his people go. And Pharaoh had a chance to let them go without God punishing him for mistreating them for all of those years. But over and over again, you see Pharaoh refused to accept God's gift of mercy and grace. And so finally, that leads God to the 10th plague, where he hits Pharaoh where it hurts the most. And this is called the plague of the firstborn. So the plague of the firstborn is your next blank. And at first, this plague that God sends can seem just to be excessively harsh. But you have to understand that God had been dealing with Pharaoh and sending these lesser judgments for several days. They had plenty of warning that they needed to turn, and especially a good warning about the firstborn plague, which we'll read about that in a minute. And I think there's a good application for us if we take a second and see that the situation with Pharaoh is really similar to how God deals with us and our sin. He doesn't just stand waiting to annihilate people on a whim as soon as they sin. He's patient, and he's long-suffering, and he turns the heat up on us slowly, intending to bring us back to repentance, to admit where we've done wrong. And he is just, and he will ultimately punish sin. But he's also kind and gentle and gives us many chances to return to him. And I think that is an amazing part of who God is. But we do need to be careful that we don't reject God's grace when it's offered to us. And I think that's one of the big lessons we see in this plague of the firstborn. If you jump to Exodus chapter 12, that's where we find this plague. We'll read about what happens. And it's actually probably better known as the Passover. And so if you're filling in that blank, you can write the Passover, better known as the Passover. So we're going to look at this in more detail. Starting in verse 3, God tells Moses and Aaron, "Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a whole lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You are to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be 8-year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and the tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. The same night, they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire, along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire, with the head, legs, and internal organs." Don't know why that was important, but it was. "Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. And this is how you're to eat, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hand. Eat in haste. It is the Lord's Passover." So you're supposed to be ready to get up and run. "On the same night, God says, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are, and when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt." It's a pretty serious moment. But let's walk through this and look at the instructions that God gives to the Israelites on how to be saved from death. And so saved from death is the next thing you would fill in there. God's giving them instructions for them to be saved. The first thing is that it must be done God's way, which sounds very familiar to what we just looked at with Abraham and Isaac. It must be done God's way. And we saw that with Adam and Eve and the fig leaves, and we saw that with Cain and Abel, and with Isaac and Abraham. God is very specific, very particular. His way is the only way. Verses 3 through 6 tell us that the Israelites were to sacrifice a lamb, that was what was going to be the sacrifice, was a lamb. That's your next blank. And then a substitute lamb is shown as a way of salvation, even in this Passover instance. Again, we're seeing that imagery. Verse 5 says there were some specific requirements of that lamb. First is that it had to be a year-old male, and so the sacrifice had to be male. It's one of your fill-ins. And if you remember, the offspring of the woman that was promised to Eve, who would defeat Satan, was also going to be male. And the ram that was a substitute for Isaac was also male. And now the Passover lamb is male. So there's this repetition that God is trying to point out to us to help us. Verse 5 tells us that the sacrifice was also going to be without defect, just like the ram that was caught by its horns in the story of Isaac. Now, this one was interesting. Verse 6 says that they were to wait till the 14th day. So they were to take care of this lamb for 4 days. And what that really meant is they were supposed to test the sacrifice. The sacrifice had to be tested, is one of your blanks to fill in there. That they were using those 4 days to see, is this lamb really an appropriate sacrifice? Is it going to be okay to be a unblemished sacrifice? And verse 6 also says that the sacrifice was going to be killed at twilight. And so killed, I think, is one of your blanks there. And here again, much like all the other examples we've been looking at, a death is required to lead to God's way of salvation in a situation. And that foreshadows salvation. And then verse 7 says that the blood of the lambs had to be applied to each household. So blood of the lambs had to be applied to each household, and that was going to be saved, that was going to be passed over. And that reminds us of the Hebrews 9, verse 22 passage that we looked at a couple weeks ago, where it says that without the shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness of sin. that God, again, keeps coming back to blood as part of his method. So everything had to be done a certain way if God's people were to be saved from the judgment that was going to come. Well, then, God follows through. The Passover happens. And that, if you jump down to verse 28, we'll read through that. Verse 28, the Israelites did just what the Lord commanded to Moses and Aaron. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all of his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was a loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. So that night, the angel of death passes through, out the land, throughout Egypt, and kills the firstborn of each house that didn't have the blood. And so every house, though, with a lamb slain, which is one of your blanks, every house with a lamb slain and blood on the doorpost was passed over. Everyone who trusted in God's plan was saved. Now let's just imagine, I'm the oldest of three boys, so imagine you're the firstborn sitting in a house that night, and your dad killed a lamb and did the blood on the door. What would be going through your mind while you're waiting till midnight? And as you start hearing the screams kind of coming down closer through the night, what do you think would be going through your mind? You can... Fear, yeah. Somebody said fear, abject fear. Somebody said, did he get it right? Did my dad do it right? Yeah. Did he mess up? I'm kind of thinking you'd be paying attention when he's doing it too. Like, this is what Moses said. If you're a type A like me. I don't know. But I think it would be so terrifying because I think you would hear house after house, scream after scream, and you would be trusting that the work your dad did was done right, because that's all you had at that point. There was no getting out of it. No, you couldn't run. You couldn't do anything. You're just stuck. So you would be trusting that your dad followed the instructions, and also that lamb met God's standards, that it really was inspected and tested and wasn't defective, that it was the right sacrifice. So I think that's good to kind of put ourselves in that spot and just wrestle with that a little. But you can also see in this, again, a reminder, just like these other examples that we've been going through, once again, God does what he says he's going to do, and he even does that in cases of judgment. He does what he says he's going to do, and every single person that trusted in God's plan and came God's way was saved. So we're seeing that again and again. God is consistent. So one application of the Passover that's important for us to kind of take home in this lesson, it's a very pivotal one, is that we have a need for a true substitute. So a true substitute is in number 3 on your outline there. Need for a true substitute. The event of the Passover is illustrating or previewing a truth that probably is one of the most, it's one of the most important truths in all the Bible. And that is that the salvation of the human race is dependent on whether or not we have a lamb that meets God's standards. So if you're filling in that little box, the salvation of the human race is dependent on whether or not we have a lamb that meets God's standards. And so for us, we need that substitute. We need a lamb. And we know that an animal can't actually be a true substitute for us as humans. The Bible will later go on and tell us that the blood of animals can never actually take away sin. That isn't how God set up the system. And in the Old Testament, as we go forward, and we'll see next week, the animal's blood only covered sin for a little while. It was temporary. All along, we have needed a deliverer, a human lamb, that would be spotless, that would be male, that would be tested and found pure, and offered as a sacrifice for us. His blood would have to be shed. And then just like this story, his blood would have to be applied to us. And in other words, that would mean we would need to take the work that he does for us and apply its results to our own situation. We would have to trust that his death was sufficient, just like the firstborn boy sitting there waiting to see if the Passover is going to clear his house or not. He's trusting that that lamb was a sufficient sacrifice. So for us, if we have that true substitute, we can have confidence that when God comes to the world in judgment, he'll pass over us because he sees that the blood of the true lamb has been applied to us. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. We'll build that out more later. But getting back to the story, as a result of this, Pharaoh finally lets the people go. Verse 31 continues the story. After midnight, it says, "During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, 'Up, like wake up, leave my people, you and the Israelites, go worship the Lord as you have requested. Take your flocks and herds, and as you've said, go. And also, bless me.'" He ends. We'll get to that. So he had to let him go because nobody can stand up to God or oppose God and win, right? In the end, he had to let them go. But it is so sick that he also says, "Oh, and also bless me," after he's been harming them, trying to kill all their male children. He also would like God to bless him on the way out. And I think sin just blinds us so badly sometimes that things like this happen. Well, then, as the Israelites are getting ready to leave, another interesting thing happens. They go around asking everybody for valuables. So they ask them for silver and gold and different things. And so they plunder the Egyptians. And verses 33 continue. It says, "The Egyptians urged the people to hurry and leave the country. So Pharaoh tells them to go, and then all the people say, 'Get out of here.' And they say, 'For otherwise, we will all die.'" So they're afraid that the rest of them are going to die too if the Israelites don't go. "So the people took their dough from their bread before the yeast was added, carried it on their shoulders in kneading troughs wrapped in clothing. And the Israelites did as Moses instructed and asked the Egyptians for articles of silver and gold and for clothing. And the Lord made the Egyptians favorably disposed towards the people, and they gave them what they asked for. So they plundered the Egyptians." And if you think back to where we started, the prophecy to Abraham said that when Abraham's descendants came out of the land, they would have great wealth. And here we find it's fulfilled exactly as God said it would be, down to even that detail, which is pretty amazing. But they're actually, even though they leave Pharaoh, they are still technically in Egypt. And they have to face another challenge, which is crossing the Red Sea. And that's found in Exodus chapter 13 and 14. As Israelites left Egypt, we're told that they were led by this pillar of cloud during the day, that God's presence was shown to them in front of them and went before them and led them where they needed to go. And then at night, it was a pillar of fire. And they were signs of God's presence leading them exactly where he wanted them to go and a visible reminder that he was with them. So they're leaving, they're marching away, and then we find Pharaoh changed his mind and chased after them. So another blank is Pharaoh changed his mind. So chapter 14, verse 5, "When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, Pharaoh and his officials changed their minds about them and said, 'What have we done? We've let the Israelites go and have lost their services.'" So they lost their slaves. So it says, "So he had his chariot made ready and took his army with him. He took 600 of the best chariots along with all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them." And so they go charging after the Israelites. And it ends up at this point where the Israelites are trapped kind of in this ravine where the Red Sea is in front of them, which is a large body of water they couldn't get across. And Pharaoh and his army are coming up behind them. And they are caught helpless. And so Moses stands up and addresses the people, talks to them as their leader. Moses answers the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand firm, and you will see the deliverance the Lord will bring you today. The Egyptians you see today, you will never see again. The Lord will fight for you. You need only to be still. So Moses is saying, you just need to be still and trust in God's plan to deliver you, and it will work out. So God speaks again to Moses, tells Moses he wants him to hold his staff out over the waters so that the waters will divide and make a way for them to get across this sea. And in verses 19 to 30, it starts to tell us how that happens. They cross the Red Sea. First, God moves the pillar. It used to be in front of the Israelites, leading them to the sea, and he moves it behind them so that it's between them and the Egyptians. And then Moses raises his hand, his staff, over the water. God drives the waters back, and the Israelites walk through on dry ground with a wall of water on the left and a wall of water on the right. Then the Egyptians start chasing after them through the sea with their horses and their chariots. And in verse 25, it says God jams their wheels, and they get stuck. And then God has Moses stretch his hand out over the sea one more time, and verse 28 tells us what happens next. It says, the water flowed back and covered the chariots and horsemen, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed the Israelites into the sea. Not one of them survived. But the Israelites went through the sea on dry ground with a wall of water on their right and on their left. And that day, the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. Sometimes the details in the Bible are just kind of morbid, but they also are part of the testimony of why the Bible is reliable. When there's these little details, you just go, interesting. If this had been redacted by Egyptian scholars, they would have taken that part out. Pretty sure. So, what an amazing moment, though, if you think about it, right? You're on the other side of the Red Sea. What an amazing moment to see. I was totally trapped, no hope. And here God delivered me from what felt like certain doom in this miraculous way. It's a pretty cool spot. So as we wrap up, let's look at just kind of a few ways that we can apply what we're learning about God's plan of redemption through this unfolding mystery. There's some pictures that we see in this Red Sea illustration that are pretty cool. It's another picture of God's plan of redemption, just like the Passover, just like Isaac's deliverance. So first of all, we see the predicament that the people are in at the Red Sea. There's nothing at all they can do. They are stuck between the sea and the army. They're waiting for death. Or if they don't get killed, they're going to get pulled back into slavery and then die eventually. So they're stuck. And this is another reminder. It's a picture of how we are helpless to do anything to save ourselves. I think that's one of the blanks you can fill out. We are helpless to do anything to save ourselves. And specifically, when it comes to sin, when it comes to dealing with the sin in our lives, we are powerless to solve our sin problem. The second piece is the people were told to stand still. So not only are they stuck and helpless, but they're told to stay there. They weren't told to make rafts or start swimming or run away or do anything on their own. And that mirrors the way that we get ready to trust in God's plan is to stay still, to realize and admit that we're helpless to save ourselves. And then be still and stop trying to clean ourselves up or make ourselves better somehow in our own strength. As long as we're still depending on our own efforts to be right in front of God, it's not going to work. That isn't his way. And that's why Moses says, stand still and see the deliverance of the Lord. So deliverance of the Lord is your next blank. And here's this principle we've covered multiple times now, that if we're going to be saved, it has to be God's plan. That's why it's the deliverance of the Lord. And it has to be his doing, because he's the only one who knows what it takes and who can actually accomplish our salvation. Another point is there was only one way to be saved. You've heard that multiple times tonight. One way to be saved. There's only one path through the sea. Hopefully you're catching the pattern. And an interesting piece that happens specifically with the Red Sea, there's really two miracles that that happen here, and they each have an application for us. One is that God opened the sea. So you can fill that in. God opened the sea. And that's significant because it means God was doing the work. God was the one who made the way for them through the sea, and their salvation had to be an act of God. So that's one application. And the second miracle is that they walked on dry land. I don't know if you ever try to walk on a lake or the bottom of a lake and your feet get stuck or your flip-flops get lost in the sediment, maybe. But this, they walked through on dry land. And the application for us that's miraculous is that when God saves a person, he does it completely. So the box at the bottom, when God saves a person, he does it completely with nothing left for us to do but enter in, trusting in God's finished work. They didn't have to tamp down the sediment or do something so they could walk across to make it. It was dry, and they could walk through because God had done the work start to finish. And we saw the same thing in the example of the flood, right? The people just needed to trust that God's plan of the ark was going to be enough to save them. And it was a finished ark. They didn't have to add anything to it. And for us, if we feel like if we look at God's plan of how to save us and we feel like, well, it's good, but I think I need to do this too. Or one common thing is that, well, God showed us the way. Christ showed us the way, or he made it possible for me to now live the life that's acceptable to God. And that's just adding our own works and our own efforts to God's plan instead of truly trusting in his work. And it's really telling God that we don't trust that his work is enough for us. It would be kind of like this. It'd be kind of like if a master carpenter creates and builds this really nice wooden chair for you and says, here, I want you to have a seat. And you look at his nice chair, and before you sit down in the chair, you grab a couple 2x4s and add another leg and another thing in the front and kind of brace it so that you know it'll hold your weight. And think about, what would that communicate to the carpenter about what you thought of the chair that he had made? You're really not trusting that his work was good enough, that it would really hold you, that it would be sufficient. And really, just like that, when we trust in the work of God, we're trusting in his work alone and not adding our own bracing or extras or whatever. We are trusting that his work is sufficient, it's enough, it is all that's needed, and that because he's promised it's enough, and he keeps fulfilling his promises and always does, that he will accept what he has said as enough for us. So that's what we learn from the Passover and the Red Sea. Next week, we're going to look more at the law and some other things that are developed from there. It should be a lot of fun. Start reading, if you want, next week, Exodus 19 and 20. We'll cover there, and then we'll keep going. But also, there's two sermons linked on those handouts. Do take a chance if you have time and listen. One is Eric's on the plagues that really ties back to the gods of Egypt and is really cool. And then the second one is Aaron did during the I Believe in Miracles series. He also covered the Red Sea, and there's a lot of really good applications to pull from that one. So try that out, and thank you all for listening. Let me pray for us. We'll hang around if you have questions or anything. All right. Lord, I just thank you so much for the beauty of these illustrations, and especially just the way they continue to point over and over to the sufficiency of the ways that you have saved your people and that you offer salvation to us. Thank you for revealing yourself to us. Thank you for not leaving us in the dark, but entering in to our world and drawing us to yourself. I pray I just continue to help these truths to sink deep into our hearts and draw us to you. Amen. All right, thanks.